British skeptical activist Michael Marshall joins the Plutopia podcast this time. We discuss his struggle to challenge pseudoscience, cults, psychics, flat earthers, vax deniers, medical quackery, basically any purveyors of misinformation.
If you want to start to be an effective communicator and you want to start to be effective at helping people check their own biases and beliefs, you come through that because you realize that's not the best tactic. Telling people they're an idiot isn't going to help them, and shouting at them and acting like you're smarter than them is never going to help people out. So if you really have the right goals in mind of trying to help people, you come through that adolescence into an understanding that, first of all, we need to know what it is these people feel, because people are led first and foremost by their emotions and not by the facts. That's true of them, it's true of us. We train our emotions to be satisfied by good answers, but our instincts first and foremost come from our gut. You know, if I said something to you that sounded false, you'd fact check it. If I said something to you that sounded true, you'd accept it. And because your gut is telling you, yeah, that sounds about right, I won't question it. So we all make these decisions based on emotion.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Plutopia News Network podcast. I am one of your co-hosts, John Lebkoski, and I'm joined by Scoop Sweeney and Wendy Grossman. And our guest today, we're joined by Michael Marshall, a leading voice in the skeptical movement and a tireless investigator of pseudoscience and misinformation. Michael is the project director of the Good Thinking Society. He's editor of The Skeptic Magazine, and he's president of the Merseyside Skeptics Society. You might know him from the long-running Be Reasonable podcast, where he spent over a decade interviewing believers in fringe ideas, like some of us, or from Skeptics with a K, where he's delivered sharp investigative reporting since 2009. His latest project, The No Rogan Experience, dives deep into the world of Joe Rogan's podcast to unpack and fact-check the claims made by Rogan and his guests, like Kash Patel, which I was listening to this morning. From organizing global protests against homeopathy to going undercover to expose fake cancer cures and psychic scams, Michael's work is as bold as it is essential. And today, we'll talk about the rise of pseudoscience, the power of compassionate skepticism, and what it really takes to change minds in this post-truth world. Welcome, Michael. How are you doing?
Oh, thank you so much. That was a really lovely introduction, and it's a pleasure to be here speaking to you all.
Good. It's great to have you. I guess the first question, just since you've spent years investigating and engaging with people who hold fringe and pseudoscientific beliefs, what drew you to this kind of work?
I think I've always been essentially interested in why people believe unusual things. I didn't come into skepticism from a science background. A lot of people are scientists who get kind of affronted by the idea that science is being abused and misused. And I didn't come from that direction. I was always somebody who was the one in my friendship group who cared that psychics were exploiting people and pretending they talk to the dead when they're not. And all my friends would say, yeah, but why do you care? You're not going to go to a psychic. Why do you care? And the answer was kind of, well, because I think it's important that we protect each other. It's important that we look out for what's true and where stuff isn't true. We should be trying to stop people selling it to people who believe it. You know, we shouldn't allow people to be deceived. And so I kind of always had this idea, this feeling that I kind of wanted to push back, but I didn't have a word for it. And then I stumbled across the word skeptic and the idea of being a skeptic, and I suddenly found myself wanting to experience every bit of pseudoscience imaginable so that I could actually see what's it like to be on the other side. You know, what are people being seduced by? And oddly enough, when we set up the Merseyside Skeptic Society, I Googled to see if there were any skeptics in Liverpool, and I saw there was a guy on there, a guy called Mike Hall, who just put a message up on Meetup saying, are there any skeptics in Liverpool? And so I determined the next day that I'd message him and we'd set up a skeptic society. And we did that, but he'd looked through my profile and he was terrified as to who he was getting involved with, because he saw my meetup said I was interested in UFOs and psychics and alternative medicine and conspiracy theories. And he thought, I'm talking to someone who's crazy, but I am interested in those things. I just don't think they're true. But I think that's what makes them interesting. Everyone else believes, but I don't think they're true, and yet they're so seductive to people. So yeah, that's why I do it. I think I'm fascinated as to why, as to how people can fall into ideas that aren't valid, that don't hold evidence, don't hold weight, and how they persuade each other, and also how they persuade themselves that it's true. Because a lot of very smart people believe very silly things, and they're very, very good at justifying those silly things to themselves because they're so smart. So yeah, I'm fascinated by the nature of belief, I think.
Yeah. Years ago, like in 1992, I guess it was 91 or 92, another guy and I started an organization called Fringeware. And originally we were just talking about like finding a way to sell fringe products online, products people had developed that they had trouble finding a way to bring to market. Hmm. We thought at the time, maybe the internet would be a way you could actually sell things to people, right? and it turned out to be true. Anyway, because we picked that name Fringeware, we had a lot of fringe people start showing up. And our email list was sort of dominated by fringe discussions that were more like people who were doing fringe thinking than people who were making fringe products. Mm. And I was shocked to understand after some time of doing this that what seemed very ironic to me, you know, where I it was kind of a lark to me, people were taking some of these things very, very seriously. And it never really occurred to me back then that they would actually start buying guns and asserting themselves aggressively. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, we don't have the gun aspect of it here in the UK is something we are thankfully not beset by. But no, I think this is the thing, is that it's, I think there was a time when it would be easy, as you say, for us to see these ideas and assume that nobody's taking them seriously. And I remember I first came across the Flat Earth movement, the modern Flat Earth movement, in about 2012, 2013, something like that. So before it became huge on YouTube, when I found the forum of the Flat Earth Society. And I was fascinated by them because I found they had a podcast where the second or third episode of their podcast, and I think there was only five episodes, it wasn't particularly long running, but I think their second or third episode, they interviewed a guy who believed in the Hollow Earth. And I thought, well, I have to listen to this because you got some people who believe the world is flat and some who think the world is hollow, and they're going to have a conversation with one another. And this is going to be incredible because these two worlds can't possibly exist together. And in the conversation, they didn't disagree hardly at all. They never talked about how their worldviews differ. They just agreed that everyone else was wrong. And that was the important thing. But when it comes to the Flat Earth movement, at the time, a lot of the people on the Flat Earth Forum were people who didn't think the world were flat, but did just think this is a fun thing, a fun pursuit. How esoteric and off the wall can I get with my proofs that the world is flat? But the problem is, they knew it was false and they were just mucking about, but they'd get quite persuasive with some of the unconventional arguments they could find, and those would persuade the people who thought the world was flat even more so. So the people who were there just to have a bit of fun were actually doing a pretty solid job of giving the believers other reasons to believe. And they were also doing a solid job of rebuffing the skeptics, because you know these intellectual trolls, essentially, they knew the world wasn't flat. They knew all of the arguments for why the world is round, and they'd already thought about how they could persuade people or use rhetoric to kind of rebuff those. And if you, the people who are coming at those conversations who thought they were more superior than the flat earthers would find themselves losing those arguments. And the flat earthers who were believers would watch on and say, well, the round earthers are wrong because here they are losing this argument to people who've got better arguments. So like, even when people were just mucking about, downstream of it was they were persuading people who did believe even harder. So yeah, we're no longer in a place where we can assume these bad ideas are held just by people who are having fun and exploring intellectual pursuits, but not really holding it. I think the world is pretty clear now that a lot of people really do believe in really irrational things, unfortunately.
I used to hear a lot that, some belief had surfaced in the States, belief in angels or some of these other things. And I'd be told that this would never take root in Britain because British people were too sophisticated or too smart or too, well educated compared to those idiot Americans, and this is kind of a trope in the media even now with respect to I remember when The Madness of King George came out and the British title ended with George the Third, and they took off the three every time that movie came up in British media, somebody would add, of course they took off the three in America because the Americans would have thought it was a sequel. And there's like this constant sort of undercurrent of digs at American stupidity, and yet, actually.
Well, but the reason they don't believe in angels in the UK is because they're obviously fairies, right?
But I mean, Wendy's right that there is this kind of assumption with some people that things that are very big in America, pseudoscience in America, wouldn't translate here, but. There are people in this country right now who believe in the QAnon conspiracy theory that Donald Trump has been sent by the good guys to take down a cabal of deep state baby blood drinking elites, and there are people in the UK who believe that, and actually think that's remarkable as to why anybody here would have that level of investment in a guy who at the time wasn't even your president, I think, but you will.
What's astonishing to me is some of the biggest fans I know of the TV show The West Wing are British people. I mean, I always thought the show was nonsense, but it turns out that there's quite a few British people who really want to believe in the strength of American democracy.
Yeah,
I find that really fascinating.
Well, I think the oversized impact of American democracy on global democracy is maybe why we kind of cross our fingers and really want to believe in the fairies that are the robust American political system, I think.
Well, Donald Trump is the deep state now anyway, right?
Well, yeah, that's true enough. That's true enough, yeah.
So, in recounting your history of skepticism, I have to ask, because I founded it, did the Skeptic magazine, which you now edit, did it play any part in your discovery of skepticism?
I'm ashamed to say it didn't, actually. I'm afraid not. Although I'm a very, very, I mean, I'm going to be honest about this. I'm not going to make things up. But yeah, no, I love being the editor of the magazine and where we've taken it since I took over in 2020. But no, my journey into skepticism was very much through podcasts. And I think it really was that I was interested in magic, not as a practitioner of it, but I was kind of interested again in how do people deceive people, what techniques are being used psychologically and other kind of things. And I was interested in the fact that Penn and Teller never speaks. And I was Googling to see what Teller sounded like, and I saw he was interviewed on a skeptical podcast. And I listened to that and I thought, oh, this is interesting. I'll listen to another one. And from there, I listened to other skeptical podcasts, and from there, I found Mike Hall, who was trying to set up a thing in Liverpool, and it kind of all expanded from there. And I think a couple of years later, I'd started my own skeptical podcast in 2009. So yeah, it wasn't the magazine, I'm afraid, but it is obviously hugely influential in the rest of skeptical world. I may be the outlier.
At one point, the back pages of the letter pages of the magazine was how skeptics found each other, because there wasn't Meetup and there wasn't the internet, and that's I mean, that's actually a good thing. I mean, one of the things that actually makes me very happy is to look at the amount of skepticism that I had nothing to do with, because I think it means that the magazine did its job.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. Yeah, I don't know how I can't imagine being involved in skepticism in that pre-internet era. Not just because how do you find other skeptics, which the magazine would be great for doing that, but also the idea of research is so completely different.
To buildings and you read books, which you actually have the books that I collected of weird ideas.
Yeah, I've got them right next to me right now. In fact, yeah. My hands on an Uri Geller book that you gave me.
Oh my God, yes. But the other part of it is that one of the things that I noticed when I first started the magazine, I would get these letters from people who were just so lonely because they were the only skeptic they knew in their town.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. And I think at least the internet has made that much, much easier. And at one point in this country, we had 30 or something, 25 or 30 different skeptics in the pub groups in various towns and cities across the country to stop people feeling alone and to build that kind of rational community. Yeah.
Yeah, COVID has really killed a bunch of them.
Yeah, it's really difficult to come back from not being able to get together when your whole kind of community, your support network drifts away to their other interests, unfortunately.
I have to confess that I am responsible for spreading a lot of that misinformation or strange information. I started in radio news and worked at a radio news service in San Francisco called Zodiac News Service. It was out to rock radio stations all over the country. And I kept finding all these things like cattle mutilations and UFOs. And I was gleefully distributing these things, more or less unchallenged. And my publisher asked me, do you believe all this stuff? I said, no, of course not, but it's interesting. Somebody published this somewhere in the country. And he described me as being a drug dealer who doesn't do drugs. And I found that one thing that really is astounding in this country, especially, is cryptozoology, all the weird sort of animals. Have you investigated any of these famous crypto animals?
No, I haven't. Although again, I find this stuff incredibly interesting. But I think it's far less common than it used to be. And I wonder whether the ubiquity of smartphones and camera phones and things has kind of made it much harder to argue that I definitely saw something and I just happened to be too stunned to get my phone out and capture a perfectly high resolution picture. It's so easy to do right now. No, I think. I kind of wish I was around in some of the earlier heydays of skepticism when it was much more about aliens and cryptids and even psychics to a degree. I mean, I got very involved in investigating psychics when I joined skepticism in 2009. But I think by that point, the people who were knowingly pulling the wool over your eyes wouldn't sit down with you in a room by that point. I think they'd kind of learned their lesson of to not sit down with skeptics. I love the idea of the previous time when someone who was a scammer thought they could outwit the skeptics, thought they'd be smarter than the scientists, and would be willing to take on the challenges. Whereas I've administered some of the challenges to people who think they're psychic. And unfortunately, the ones that I've been involved with are people who I think are sincere in their beliefs and are just misguided for whatever reasons. But yeah, no, I think in terms of cryptozoology, the pseudoscience landscape had already moved on into things like psychics and then even more so into things like alternative medicine by the time I really got involved in 2009, 2010. And we've evolved again into conspiracy theory, unfortunately.
Well, I've
Except for the
seen,
Loch Ness Monster.
yeah, I was just going to say the Loch Ness Monster and in my area, the Chupacabra. And there are people who have faked up plenty of chupacabras. They found mutated dogs and coyotes, but no real actual goat sucker. But
Yeah.
that stuff still gets mentioned on television quite often. There are some adventure guys who go around exploring all these mysteries of Bigfoot and Mothman and Chupacabra and the Yeti. And I'm just amazed that no one seems to come up with a in-focused photograph.
Absolutely that, yeah.
A couple of years ago, I wrote about this for Skeptical Inquirer. A couple of years ago, somebody had a weekend big search for Nessie, and we're going to settle this thing. And I realized it, and actually, I realized while that was going on that it was in no one's interest to actually get a good photograph of the Loch Ness Monster, because as long as it might be there, you can sell the thing, and you can get people to come up to the cafe and visit and spend tourist money and so forth. But once you actually find it, if you found a monster in the bottom of the lake, I'm not sure people would actually want to go there anymore.
No, that's true. It's in no one's interest to find the picture, least of all Nessie, who I presume is incredibly shy, and that's why they've not raised their head above the water for several decades, I think, by this point. I think that's maybe it, is that you have stories like Chupacabra, and I think there was some great research done, I think, by Ben Radford, who was able to track that back to a lot of the sightings he attributed to the filming of the film Species. A lot of the early sightings of Chupacabra, the description that they have and the area that it was, it's likely to be highly influenced by the filming of a film, of a sci-fi film that was happening at the time. But Chupacabra at least is relatively recent, and that's in the 90s, I think, or something in that kind of area. But it's relatively rare that you get new cryptids. I'm not sure when the last kind of real cryptid that caught the imagination was. All the ones that we can name, things like, you know, Bigfoot and the Yeti and Nessie, they're decades and decades old. And I think that's maybe for me why cryptozoology feels a lot less current and urgent, because we're at this point, there's only so much I can do to investigate a Nessie photo that was taken in the 40s, for example. If someone was claiming there was something in the Mersey here in Liverpool where I live, I'd be down there tomorrow to try and check out what they may have seen.
Well, I often wonder why we would think that, say, an abominable snowman or a Bigfoot would be more interesting than a bear, or that a Loch Ness monster would be more interesting than a whale. You know, I mean, we have monsters that are well-established monsters, right? Mm. I mean, it's just the weirdness of the thing. It's like, because it's a little bit different and people have only seen fleeting bits of it, they build it into some kind of mythology that is somehow interesting to them. I just never thought cryptids were very interesting myself, I guess.
I think the thing that I find interesting about them, and I've not spent time researching them, other friends of mine have. There's a researcher here in the UK called Hayley Stevens, who does a lot of stuff in terms of cryptozoology and paranormal hunts and things like that. I think the thing that's most interesting to me about cryptids is not about what they are or aren't physically, but what they say about the societies that see them, is that you often have the behaviors of the cryptid to kind of reflect the fears that we might have of a society or things that we're worried about. I think maybe not so much with Nessie and things like that, but you see there's some fantastic vampire-like creatures from East Asia that will come through your window in the dead of night and steal the blood out of your baby, or steal the soul out of your baby and things. And these types of stories, I think, arise because of real-world phenomena like, you know, sudden infant death syndrome and outbreaks of disease that we previously wouldn't have been able to understand. So why are people dying all of a sudden? Well, it can't be because there's this invisible thing called a germ that spreads around in ways that we can't see. It must be a monster coming for us. And what I think is interesting about that is that sounds like really old-fashioned thinking. It sounds like, you know, pre-modern thinking. But what did we see during the pandemic? That's not a germ. It can't be a germ that's doing it. It's COVID isn't really a virus. A virus can't be doing this. It must be something else. It's a bioweapon. It's 5G towers. It's the new thing that's scary rather than the old thing that's mundane but deadly. So the way that we deal with fears, the grammar of it hasn't changed, but the vocabulary of it has, I suppose.
Well, yeah, and it couldn't be just a normal virus. It has to be one that was genetically engineered in some lab.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I think one of my biggest fears is that we will finally encounter aliens and they'll turn out to be really boring.
Yeah, I mean, this is the other thing that I think is really interesting when it comes to aliens, is that everybody wants all the different sightings in the sky to be aliens. And I've interviewed lots of people who claim that they've seen things in the sky or that they've studied UFOs at length. And one of the things I often ask is, well, why are all of the different crafts that are spotted different shapes? Are these different races of aliens, different species of aliens who all happen to have converged on our planet at this time and they've brought their own technology? Or is this the same species who for some reason has come in completely disparate versions of what an aircraft or a spacecraft would look like? Why is there no consistency? You know, when we see something in the sky, it's typically a plane or a helicopter and they all look about the same. Every plane looks broadly like a plane, but every UFO pretty much looks like a different shape, a different way of flying. And that seems like a very inefficient way for an alien species to make its way across the galaxy to us.
Well, there are big TV shows on cable TV in the U.S. that really help spread this. One of my favorites to watch is Ancient Aliens, just because I'm fascinated by the host's weird hairdo. I'm missing a lot of hair, so I always wanted to have a hairdo like that. But it just seems like there are a lot of people who really believe that ancient aliens created all these great things like the pyramids and, the Romans' use of water aqueducts that were all ancient aliens. And have you experienced anything like that in your area? I mean, is it as popular there as it is here, having ancient aliens?
Yeah, so I think the idea that ancient aliens built some of the most kind of impressive structures in history is certainly one that flourishes here in Britain. Typically less about British structures. And I don't know whether that speaks to the old-fashioned British exceptionalism. You know, the aliens didn't build Stonehenge. This was actually a druidic society who were so forward-thinking and advanced that they could line these stones up in a perfect way, so on the solstice, etc., etc. They typically don't attribute it to aliens. And I think when you look at a lot of the places around the world that people do attribute to ancient aliens, it's rare that they bring Rome into it, actually. Rome, Greece, these aren't the places. Very few people, I don't think I've ever come across anyone saying that the Colosseum was built by aliens. But they will say that the pyramids were, and they will say that Machu Picchu was, and they'll say that, you know, large structures found in Africa were. And I think partly this comes to a largely Western colonialist idea of, well, we, the smart people who built these amazing things in Italy and Greece and Britain, we were capable of that. But the rest of the world at the time weren't as sophisticated as us Europeans. So they can't have done it. They must have had help from other, you know, external intelligences. So I think it does have this European exceptionalism, this kind of racist tinge of these other peoples were too primitive to be able to do these remarkable things. And obviously what it misses is that human beings have remarkable brains wherever you go and whenever you go through history, and at different times they've been capable of different things. But that kind of challenges this European-centric narrative of civilization. You know, the Renaissance and civilization started in Greece and Rome and spread out from there and civilized the world. And the world said, thank you very much. And obviously that's not how history actually happened.
I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about something that I think is really much weirder than UFOs or cryptids. And it's something we have right here in Austin. It's called Joe Rogan. Because I know that you've been studying Joe Rogan quite a bit, and I have tried to understand what makes this man a success.
Well, I think the reason that, so since the start of the year, I've been doing a podcast called The No Rogan Experience. And the reason really was, after the American election, to whatever degree, it certainly seems that Rogan had an outsized influence for a podcaster on certain parts of American demographic, largely men, largely young men, seem to sort of follow him. And I've been critical of Rogan for some time. My colleague Cecil, who I do the show with, has been critical. But it occurred to both of us that we've never listened to Joe Rogan. So while we're critical of him, it's from an uninformed perspective. It's from a distance. And I think that's true of a lot of the people who will say, well, he was a massive anti-vaxxer during the pandemic. But the people saying that haven't listened to what he's actually said. And so that, well, if we're going to try and reach the people who are being persuaded into terrible ideas from Joe Rogan and his wider kind of ecosystem of podcasters, we need to be able to talk authentically and you know, knowledgeably about what it is that he's saying and what it is that he claims. Because if we get that wrong, if we say, well, he says that the world's flat and he says it isn't flat, then we're going to look like fools and no one's going to listen to us. So we decided we'd actually listen to what it is that he's talking about. And some of the stuff that I found remarkable is, so before the election, he had a series of guests, Callie and Casey Means. He had RFK Jr. on. He had Trump on. He had a few other people too. And in those interviews pre-election, they basically lay out what they're going to do when they get in. And they talk about Callie and Casey Means. I think Casey Means was put forward for the one of your leading medical roles, I think, under Trump's administration. They outline, when we get in, we're going to be going for metabolic health. We're going to be coming after food in this way. We're going to be pushing these kind of ideas. And this was all in September, October, August of last year, August of before the election. So it feels like, had we been listening at the time, we would have seen the blueprint for what the worst parts of the Trump administration are doing. But people like me and you guys weren't listening.
Yeah.
And so
I listened to Rogan for years.
Oh, did you? Okay.
I have enough insomnia that I needed a podcast that was long. And I discovered Rogan because he interviewed an expert on doping methods in sports. He interviewed Victor Conti, who ran the Balco, which was the center of a big scandal. So I listened to that and I thought, well, who else has he interviewed? And I haven't actually heard him since he signed the deal with Spotify, because I don't subscribe to Spotify. But I have listened to many Rogan podcasts. And the thing that I notice about him, or at least in that period, he may have changed since he got onto Spotify. The thing I noticed is that he was the kind of person who would more or less agree with whatever his guest said, and that worked as a way of drawing the guest out to flesh things out further. And that's can be a very effective way of interviewing people. And so he would do, you know, he did a 3-hour interview with Lawrence Lessig. But the one that really, really was interesting to me is that right at the beginning of the pandemic, like in mid-March of 2020, he interviewed a guy named Michael Osterholm, who is a very well-respected doctor in Minnesota. And Osterholm, in the first few minutes of that podcast, said, this thing is coming, it's serious, it's airborne, and there's going to be a lot of disruption, and we're not going to get over this easily. And I said, okay, I should listen to this guy, and I should pay attention to what he said. And actually, I was helped through the pandemic by that podcast. And then I hear everybody trashing Rogan, and I go, well, wait a minute, that's not actually necessarily how he operates.
Yeah, I think he has changed. So one of the things we've been doing is going back to some of the earlier days of Rogan, and I think you're absolutely right. Certainly early on, he would reflect back what his guest was saying. The way I describe it is essentially, for all its machismo, for all it being this incredibly macho, you know, masculine bro type space on the internet, I think it's the most conflict averse space I've ever found on the internet. Because what happens in that room, Joe Rogan will roll with pretty much anything you want to say, rather than have any friction there, except on a very small number of topics. I mean, he interviewed Bernie Sanders recently, and Bernie Sanders was talking through his political philosophy of democratic socialism, and Rogan is on board all the way until Bernie mentions climate change, and Rogan noticeably shifts and starts pushing back. But that's the only kind of moment of pushback.
Have you heard Rogan talk about how he only eats meat he's caught himself?
Yeah, he will say that from time to time. Yes, yeah. He says that's one of the things we covered on one of his interviews. He was saying, I don't understand why people go to the supermarket and buy meat in the supermarket, because you're so divorced from the process of killing an animal and skinning an animal and things, to really understand where the meat comes from. And also, it's much cleaner meat. It's better meat for you if you catch it for yourself. Why aren't people hunting? And you know, part of the answer to that is, Joe, not everybody podcasts for a living. Some people have proper jobs and they can't afford to drive to their local forest and get out a bow and arrow and start waiting for a deer to arrive. That's quite time consuming for people who have quite pressured lives.
Yeah, I hear all the cats disappeared from his neighborhood.
But what I do think is true about Rogan is that I think he has changed in the time that we've been in the sampling that we've done of his back catalogue. And while he still will, in the moment, roll with whatever people are saying to him, I think his baseline for where his positions are gets anchored by the number of people of a certain persuasion that he has on. And he'll have, you know, a load of tech billionaires on, and they will change the way that he thinks about taxation and change the way he thinks about laws and policies, that he doesn't return to Rogan pre that conversation. And one thing that we found that's really interesting is
he himself is much richer now, so that's also going to be changes.
And he's moved away from California to a place in Austin where he surrounded himself with people who like him an awful lot, and that's kind of how he builds a community. And I think there's an echo chamber there. He has people flying out to his guests will fly out to Austin and spend time there with him, and that has a kind of a kingmaker element. I think that stops you being a good police of your own ideas and checking your own biases. But what I think is particularly important about the fingerprint that he leaves on the American social narrative, or the landscape, the political landscape, is if you want to smuggle a bad idea into millions of people's minds, go on Joe Rogan and tell him it. And it's not about your time. It's not the show where Mark Andreessen, the tech billionaire, goes on and talks about how the consumer watchdog for financial affairs. I forget the name of it.
Consumer financial.
Yeah, the CF
Protection Bureau.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So Mark Andreessen goes on and demonizes that, saying they're going to come for you. They're going to take away your bank account. Any one of you could be debanked any moment. And his evidence for that is he had some cryptocurrency businesses that weren't able to get a bank account because they're high risk. So that's very different to what the average person's bank account experience is going to be like. But it's not just the interview he's doing at the moment. That's not the thing that really has the impact. What has the impact is every time a topic similar to that comes up on future Rogan shows, he goes into his memory banks of what he knows about that topic, and he comes up with the talking points he was given by that guest a few months ago. And you can actually track the when Rogan learns of an idea. I saw him talking to Lex Fridman about Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And in that conversation, he brings up, well, you know, that Russia, NATO promised Russia that there'd be no expansion towards the east. And then the US instigated a coup in Ukraine. And I thought, well, those are unusual views for Rogan to have. And I looked back through his back catalog of shows, and I found the interview where he was told that by one of his guests. And his guest has picked that up, you know, second and third hand. I found the original source of it. And the original source was an article in a German newspaper written by Vladimir Putin. And so you have literal Russian propaganda laundered through several means, makes it to a guest on Joe Rogan. They say it. Months later, Joe Rogan is repeating this as if it's true. And it stays in his brain. And I describe it as like his brain is like an Etch-a-Sketch, you know, the kid's toy that you draw shapes on, and it'll retain the shape until you shake it for long enough, and eventually it'll fall away. And his brain can only retain the last few things that he's been told, but he will continually repeat those and show those to everybody until eventually they fade away.
And that's where his choice of guests really matters, because if he no longer has the kinds of guests that produce, you know, if he no longer has Michael Osterholm. Osterholm tried to get back on the show, you know, a couple of years later, because and correct some of the things that Rogan was broadcasting, and Rogan didn't take him up on it.
Yeah, exactly. And he will occasionally have some reasonable guests on. And so people will look at that list and say, well, that person's good, I'm going to listen to that show. But they won't listen to the show where he talks to Daryl Cooper. Daryl Cooper is an amateur historian who does podcasts about World War II, who explains that actually Germany had it really bad in World War II. And if you were a German soldier, you would do all those things. And maybe actually there was provocation that caused Hitler to invade Poland, and it's Nazi apologism. And Rogan has that conversation with Daryl, and then he brings that up on future shows as if that's true.
You mentioned Rogan's followers. He lured a bunch of his comedian friends out to Austin on promises that they were going to become really big out here. And apparently they've begun returning to California because that promise, like many of his promises, didn't pan out.
Yeah, I think so. But he does have this ecosystem around him of similar podcasters who either get their audience from appearing on Joe Rogan, or who have like an exchange of guests, or Rogan will go on their show. So there is this, not just the top level harm of the pseudoscience and the conspiracy theory that's pushed all the time, and the outright propaganda, in fact, traceable propaganda that gets pushed on Rogan. The other part of it that I think is of interest and of concern is that you'll have somebody will go on Joe Rogan and they will seem relatively reasonable. They'll have a conversation about conspiracy theories. They won't seem too out there. And maybe one of Joe Rogan's 20 million listeners will think that guy seemed interesting. I'm going to follow him to his podcast. And when you get to that guy's podcast, not only are his views a lot less constrained, a lot less reasonable, but his guest list is another layer beyond the ones that Joe Rogan would have. And so you have this system where Joe is, in my mind, unthinkingly, not deliberately, acting as a gateway to recruit people into a pipeline of further and further media that gets further and further extreme.
A sort of ratchet.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's the first point on that ratchet. He's the entry point to that. And some people will just stay at Rogan, but others will follow further down.
I mean, some of the time I have actually listened to Rogan podcasts to find out what a name in the media actually thought.
Mm.
You know, because it can be useful, like you say. One of my friends said to me, "Oh, yeah, this Robert F. Kennedy sounds really, you know, he sounds pretty sensible." Not over 3 hours, he doesn't.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. I mean, you asked at the start, what is it about Joe Rogan that makes him so successful? He will say it's the fact that he's willing to have these long conversations. And I actually agree. The idea of having a 3 hour conversation rather than a 5 minute conversation, you know, a soundbite conversation with a politician doing the whistle stop tour of an election campaign, you get very little out of a politician. Then they're just going to repeat the same kind of talking points, or a celebrity who's on the press junket who tells the same anecdote to 50 different journalists. That's not going to be, you're never going to learn anything about them. Whereas sit them down for 2 or 3 hours and you will learn a lot more. But the problem is that Joe thinks that not only will that person reveal a bit more about themselves, but Joe will be able to get to the bottom of who they are. And while he can be a guy who's got curiosity, he can genuinely have an interest in finding out interesting information. The one thing that never occurs to him is the person sat opposite me lying to me? Are they completely full of nonsense here? It never crosses his mind to do that, because that would be to introduce friction and conflict. So instead, he works really hard to square their circle, essentially.
Speaking of nonsense, have you listened to much of Alex Jones, another of our local media morons, I guess?
Yeah, I have, mostly through other means. So there's a podcast called Knowledge Fight, which looks at InfoWars and explains everything that's going on. And that does a really good job of saying, this is what Alex Jones is saying, and here's kind of what he's building and what he's talking about. I think Alex Jones is a different character to Joe Rogan, in that I think a lot of what Alex Jones is saying, he doesn't believe it. He is just trying to sell supplements. He is just trying to build this picture, this elaborate fiction, and he knows it's a fiction. And so to analyze Alex Jones, you almost have to pick apart the worldview that he's building and point out where the bricks are and which kind of fictive bricks are in there. Whereas the thing I thought I'd see something similar with Joe Rogan when I went to this project, and I don't see that. I think he genuinely does believe the positions he's putting forward. There's been very few times that I've got the sense that he's doing anything at all cynically. And the only time that I think one of the only times anything looked remotely cynical was when he did a long interview with Donald Trump just before the election. And it was pretty clear that he was 100% already on Trump's train, but had decided to portray himself as, well, I'm on the fence. I could go either way on this. But when you watch in detail, as we did, the questions he asks Trump and the way that he structures that interview, it is entirely designed as a PR campaign, to a point where there's points where Rogan even says, well, you know, if you're interested in Trump, he's the guy you should be voting for. He's great. You should get out there and vote for him. And yeah, that's the only time I think I've seen him be cynical, whereas I don't think I've ever seen Alex Jones not be cynical. And the interesting thing, the two guys are good friends. I mean, Rogan and Jones go way back. I think on 9/11, Alex Jones was on air during 9/11, and Joe Rogan phoned in to tell Alex Jones off for spreading 9/11 truth myths. Rogan called in on the day to say, this is irresponsible speculation. So that's where Rogan used to be. He's come a long way since then.
Do you ever try to cultivate skepticism in others?
Yeah. I think it's something I try and do a lot. Obviously, we have our local community groups where we host events and things, but I try to, as much as possible, talk to people that I disagree with. That's what Be Reasonable as a show was. I'm not doing Be Reasonable at the moment, but I have long conversations with people who believe deeply unusual things. Even when the pandemic started, the first thing that I did, I saw that there was these propagandist stickers on lampposts and street posts around Liverpool, where I live, that were saying, there isn't a virus, COVID isn't real, your government's out to get you. And they had a QR code that you could scan to find out more information. So being the inquisitive type that I am, I scanned that QR code and I ended up in a private messaging group with 50,000 members around the world who were all spreading anti-vax misinformation and COVID denialist stuff. And I spent about a year, I think, or something in that kind of region, documenting what was going on in there, just watching. And then I give a talk about what I'd seen and why I was concerned not just for the health misinformation, but for the way that that space was being used by cynical actors who were trying to recruit people to extremist ideologies. You know, I want you to be a member of this far right group, so I'm going to start saying anti-vax stuff, and you'll share my information into your group, and your group will get used to trusting me. And then when I start to say some of the stuff I really believe, some of those people will follow me. And I give a whole talk about this, and I got outed in that group as a journalist. They said, Michael here is a journalist. He's been spying on us for months, which was a little worrying because I was talking about how they had violent tendencies. They had extremist ideologies in there. I was a bit worried for my safety. Fortunately, I was okay. But the leader of the local group, who was part of the international organization group, messaged me afterwards to say, what have you got to say for yourself? You've been spying on us for months. How dare you be watching us? How do you justify that? And I said, I haven't lied to you at any point. I've never tried to goad you into saying something extreme. I have these concerns. If you want to know what my concerns are, come and watch my YouTube talk about it. And I did the YouTube talk. And as soon as I finished, I got a message from him on Telegram, the messaging service, where he said, you're right. You're absolutely right. I didn't see it because my channel was filled with spam bots and crypto scammers and Nazis that were obvious to kick out. I didn't see that the people whose names I knew, whose faces I knew, who I'd met, were now saying more and more extremist things than they were 6 months ago. I didn't see them getting radicalized. And so we had a conversation back and forth over a period of months where I said, if you have any questions at all about the pandemic, about the vaccine, anything, please just ask me. I'll never judge you. I've been honest about who I am. Let's have a conversation. And we had a really open conversation. He asked me all sorts of stuff. And by the end, he left the conspiracy group. He left being anti-vaxxer. He joined our local skeptics group, and he talked about how he wanted to be more critical thinking in his approach. And he even spoke out about how harmful vaccine misinformation was. And he said he did that because rather than being shouted at like he was whenever he was on the street at anti-vax protests, people who were, you know, pro-vaccine, who knew COVID was dangerous, were shouting abuse and were calling him names and things. That didn't change his mind. But being able to just honestly exchange conversation with somebody who would listen and not judge and offer information without kind of pomposity or superiority, that's what helped him find his own way out of the rabbit hole. So yeah, I think encouraging people to be skeptical is incredibly important. And it's why we need to understand the ideas that we're challenging before we have those conversations. Because if I didn't have an authentic understanding of what his concerns were from having kind of been around that space, I'd have not been able to connect with him, and maybe that opportunity would have passed. So we need to listen to people first, unfortunately. Yeah.
Are there skeptics that don't have an open mind but just want to deny things?
Yeah. Unfortunately, there are. And of course there are, because there are people who come into this worldview from all sorts of different backgrounds. And some of those backgrounds may be growing up in very controlling religions. So maybe you grew up in a, Mormonism or Jehovah's Witnesses or very extreme Christianity or Islam, and that would lock down your worldview, and you weren't allowed to question certain things. And then you discover that you don't believe that, and you discover there's this whole world out there, and people will often rush into, I'm awake now, and everybody else who used to believe that is wrong or gullible, or I'm going to tell everybody everything, and I'm going to tell them how wrong they are. I'm going to set the world to rights. And we all kind of go through that moment, I think, where you discover this stuff is nonsense and you want to tell people the truth, and you become evangelical almost about skepticism. But I think I describe that as kind of a skeptical adolescence. And if you want to start to be an effective communicator, and you want to start to be effective at helping people check their own biases and beliefs, you come through that because you realize that's not the best tactic. Telling people they're an idiot isn't going to help them, and shouting at them and acting like you're smarter than them is never going to help people out. So if you really have the right goals in mind of trying to help people, you come through that adolescence into an understanding that, first of all, we need to know what it is these people feel, because people are led first and foremost by their emotions and not by the facts. That's true of them. It's true of us. We train our emotions to be satisfied by good answers, but our instincts first and foremost come from our gut. You know, if I said something to you that sounded false, you'd fact check it. If I said something to you that sounded true, you'd accept it. And because your gut is telling you, yeah, that sounds about right, I won't question it. So we all make these decisions based on emotion. So we have to understand what emotions are at play for the people who are believing these things, and what need do these ideas meet, and how do we kind of start to get to the bottom of that? If you ask somebody, why do you believe in something? They often won't tell you why they believe. They'll tell you why they think you should believe. But those two are often very different. The reason they believe is something is often something completely different, and you need to try and get to that before you can have any hope of helping people question what they believe.
Have you looked at any of the neo-fascist, neo-Nazi promoters that have swung, especially among young people? It seems to have been popularized, and I'm not really sure why.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I was pointing out during the pandemic was how much of those anti-vax groups. I think the reason that I really went on that long project on the it was called the White Rose, was the COVID denialist anti-vax group. It was called the White Rose, which ironically enough is named after a student uprising in Munich against the Nazi regime during the 30s, where students would leave leaflets around Munich pointing out why we should be questioning what the Nazi government was doing. And those students, unfortunately, were all killed within about 9 months or so of being part of the White Rose movement. So this White Rose Telegram group, the reason I was so interested in what was going on with it was when I first found that sticker on a lamppost and I scanned the QR code, the first thing I saw was an anti-vax meme. And the second thing I saw was a video captioned, "This beautiful white woman explains why it isn't wrong to love your white race. And it doesn't mean that you hate everyone else, but you just value your own race." And when I clicked on that, it was from a white supremacist channel that was pushing its information into this anti-vax space. And so I think there was a realization from a lot of actors at the time that this disaffected portion of society, this were people who, again, talking about emotions, people were scared, people were unsure, we were all scared, it was all very uncertain. People didn't know what to do for the best, their lives were falling apart, especially if they had a business that required people to be there in person. They suddenly couldn't necessarily pay their rent or keep their business together, and those are terrifying things. And because of the fear that was going around, it made people susceptible to simple answers. And there were these neo-Nazi groups and people like Tommy Robinson in the UK, who was a massive, who became a massive anti-vaxxer as soon as the pandemic started. Before that, he was just a white supremacist. But funnily enough, he decided he disliked the vaccine as soon as he saw that there's a lot of people who disliked the vaccine. They saw this disaffected group of people and thought, if I say enough things that agree with them, I can fish in that pool and bring some people over to me. And I think that's true not just of the pandemic, but we see it with other kind of other ideas too. We see it with oppositions to gay and trans people. I think a lot of that is driven by people who are trying to recruit people to their ideas and to get them to agree with them on that issue and therefore bring them over to others. I think we see a similar thing with the way that the anti-abortion movement is smuggling itself in other rhetoric first and foremost, in order to try and say, well, I lost the abortion fight, but if I can get you to agree that we need to protect children from these horrible elites who are doing all these things, then I can push you further and further back to my position. So I think there is a rise of this extremist ideology, especially the white supremacist ideology, and they're smuggling it through other ideas first and foremost.
The American right is a theory called the Great Replacement Theory that is, of course, catering to the racist, particularly in the American South, where that's still a big selling point. If you're a racist, you're one of their people.
Yeah, and so the thing with the Great Replacement, it's something I've written about for the magazine. Obviously, the Charlottesville Tiki Torch marches, people will know that those people, those racists were chanting, "Jews will not replace us." And what people will misunderstand about that, those people weren't worried that their place would be taken by Jewish people. The Great Replacement idea is that there is a shadowy Jewish elite who are going to replace those white people with people of color. So black and brown people and Muslims. So you will be, and Hispanic people. The idea of the Great Replacement is that your place, the strength of the white race will be diluted deliberately by Jewish elites in order to weaken white control of America. It's this ridiculous conspiracy theory, often called the Kalergi plan, from a guy who came up with it in Europe in, I think, the 40s or something in that kind of region. And these ideas, I think the reason they take hold with racist people, obviously, because they're designed to, but they also take hold with people who are fearing the change in their lives because they can't see security for themselves. It's much harder to get your foot on the property ladder. It's harder to secure a rental place at a decent price. And the answer to that isn't there are too many immigrants here. the answer is there aren't enough rent controls, and you know, property prices have spiraled, and there's a level of wealth that wealth transfer between generations that has broken down for the first time in a century or something like that. Those answers, unfortunately, are big systemic issues that to change them would require political power, which is exactly what the people who are worried don't have. The disenfranchised people who are worried about where their rent's coming from and how they're going to carry on paying their mortgage and in America their healthcare. You know, they don't have the political power, so they will, instead of looking up at who's in charge and who's keeping those structures in place, they'll be persuaded to look at the people who've got less than them, because scapegoating has always been effective. And so, yeah, I think not everybody who believes a great replacement is necessarily a dyed-in-the-wool racist, or they'd hate to be dyed in the wool. I think it's exactly what they wouldn't want to be. But not everybody is a racist, but those ideas gain traction because of other insecurities and fears that can be preyed upon by racists.
And existing divisions also.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there are parts of the U.S. where white people are actually being somewhat outnumbered by members of other races. And I have the sense that that's causing some anxiety for some people, that they really do fear that suddenly their race will be the minority and these other guys will be the majority. And, you know, to me, it's weird because I don't really like that. I don't even want to think in terms of race. I mean, people are just people, right? But I know that people think that way. And it seems to be, especially, there's a lot of tension right now about that in the U.S., for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, and here too as well, that we have a similar kind of, we have, you know, rising parties from the right and media empires from the right in terms of GB News who are there to push those kind of narratives. But I think those tensions, those frictions are less likely to bubble to the surface when people are feeling secure financially, when they're feeling secure that they can see a future for themselves, they can see a future for their kids in terms of, I know that I'm going to have this house and my housing isn't going to be insecure and my health isn't going to be insecure because I've got good health coverage and I can send my kids to college and there's not so much of a competition for places because of other factors that I don't see a future for them. I think when people can see their lives flourishing or can see a plan for their lives flourishing, they're less likely to have those tensions. They're still going to be there. People will have an insecurity about things they're not used to. Certainly where I grew up in the UK, over in the northeast of the UK, it was a very white area. I think there was maybe you could spend your whole life in my village and you'd only see white faces essentially. And the way that people would talk about anyone of any other race was quite different to when I moved to Liverpool, and there is much more of a racial diversity. Here in Liverpool, there's just not as much of an issue because people will meet people of all backgrounds and recognize that we're just people. But if you've almost never met anyone from a different background of a different race, there's an uncertainty, there's a lack of knowledge, that and a lack of familiarity that can breed fear, especially when you're in these other ways kind of uncertain and insecure in your life. So yeah, I think it's always a much more complex factor, I think, than straight this person's racist or not. I think there's all these other things that bring these tensions to the surface and encourage them in people too.
So much of what we see is just coming from a rational fear, I guess.
Yeah, well, we make our decisions based on our emotions, and our negative emotions are the ones that are most likely to motivate us, because if we were predominantly motivated by our positive emotions, we'd lack the same sense of self-preservation when there are stresses and threats. If we generally felt quite secure even when there was a threat, we probably wouldn't have survived to breed and pass our genes long enough. I mean, that might just be a bit of cod of evolution psychology that might not be evidence-based, but it feels right in the moment.
We're getting close to the end of the hour. One other thing I wanted to ask you is, what really of all of this work that you've been doing as a skeptic and promoting a more skeptical mindset, what's been the most rewarding part of that for you?
Oh gosh, that's a good question. some of the projects that I've taken on since I've been a full-time skeptical activist have been rewarding in the outcome that they've had. So one of the first things I ever did, we started our local skeptics group in February 2009. And midway through 2009, we decided we didn't want to just put events on. We wanted to be an activist organization. And so we were looking around at what we could do. And we realized that in the UK, homeopathy was incredibly popular. Most people would have seen it on the shelves of our local pharmacists. It was provided on the National Health Service or publicly funded healthcare. Everybody knew it was there. But most people didn't know what homeopathy was. If you asked people, what is homeopathy? They'd have said it's natural medicine, it's herbal medicine. They wouldn't have known that it's based on the idea that the more you dilute something, the stronger and more effective it gets. And the therefore most effective medicine, most effective homeopathic medicine is so diluted, there's nothing in it at all. And so we thought, well, how do we tell people that? If people heard that, the average person on the street, if they heard homeopathy, they don't know what it is. But if you told them, if they knew, the more diluted it is, the stronger it gets, the more strong remedies have got nothing in them, everybody would recognize that can't be effective. That's not how it works. That must be nonsense. So we thought, well, what can we do to send that message? And we came up with the idea of Boots, the pharmacy, is the biggest pharmacy chain in the UK, and they sell homeopathy. We said, what if we were to go into Boots, everybody around the country, all at the same time, on the same day, and buy some homeopathic sleeping pills, and then stand outside of Boots on camera with videos and take an overdose of those sleeping pills. And if nobody falls ill, if nobody has any ill effects, that's going to be pretty clear that these are just sugar pills. And so we had 300 people, I think it was, around the UK in something like 13 cities across the country, all at exactly 23 minutes past 10 in the morning, take this overdose. It was called the 1023 campaign. I came up with the name of it. This is one of the satisfying parts of it. I came up with that name because whenever you read news stories about homeopathy, the media would say, these are very dilute remedies, they're natural remedies with almost nothing in it. They wouldn't say, there is nothing in it. So I thought, how do I make sure that when the media cover this, they say, there is nothing in it? So we called on our campaign 1023 after the Avogadro limit, which is the chemical principle that explains the more you dilute something, you're going to pass a point where there is nothing in it and it can't be effective. And that Avogadro limit is one drop of a remedy, one drop of, you know, whatever, to 6.02 times 10 to the power of 23 drops of water, which is a phenomenally large amount of water. So if we call our campaign 1023 after that chemical principle, and we do it at exactly 10:23 a.m., after the chemical principle, when the media report on this, they can't not mention why 1023. And so this was front page of the BBC News all day. It made every national newspaper, it made newspapers internationally. And every single one of those pieces of reporting said the group takes its name from the chemical principle that demonstrates there is nothing in homeopathy. And there was somebody who did an analysis of the way the public understanding of homeopathy in the UK afterwards and found that awareness of what homeopathy actually was raised after that event. We ran it the next year internationally and had, 1,700 people in 70 cities in 30 different countries, all taking part at 10:23 local time. We had a research scientist in Antarctica taking a homeopathic overdose on camera. It made national news in so many different countries around the world. Wendy took part in the UK version of it where I think it was 250 people or 300 people all in one room took a homeopathic overdose at the same moment at QED.
It was at the convention that you ran called QED for COVID, demonstrandum. It turns out that when a room full of 250 people all chew on sugar pills at the same time, it makes a really, really loud crunch.
Yeah, it really does. And so that was rewarding in that we got a lot of press coverage and some awareness. We were told by the Polish skeptics that sales of homeopathy dropped by 15% after their demonstration because people read it and thought, well, this can't be real then. But that was good for public awareness, but it didn't change things in the UK. It was still on the shelves of pharmacies. It was still on the NHS. And so when I got a job working full time for a skeptical charity, I started to look at, well, why is it on the NHS? And I, through freedom of information, asked every different part of our National Health Service, you know, hundreds of different bodies, how much money do you spend on homeopathy and when do you give me the contracts and things? And what we found was there were only a few parts of the country where all of the spending was taking place. And so I was able to look at the contract decisions when the next time the contract was coming up for renewal, and it came up for renewal in Liverpool, where they were spending £60,000 on homeopathy. I wrote to every local doctor in Liverpool to say, did you know they're spending money on homeopathy? That money could go on something that isn't homeopathy. You know homeopathy doesn't work. You should take part in this public consultation. And so they got a huge number of people actually writing to this public consultation, and they decided to stop funding homeopathy. And then we did the same in another part of the country, and again and again, and now there isn't any homeopathy on the NHS. And that was as a direct result of understanding the size of the picture, figuring out where the pressure points were, what could be done about it, and then following through. And so that was my work. And that's the rewarding thing, I think, because I've had a tangible effect of, I think, £5 million a year of National Health Service money no longer goes on ineffective remedies.
That's great. That reminds me of an ad I once saw that said, genuine placebo. Well, thanks so much for joining us. This has been a great conversation.
Oh, I've enjoyed this a lot. Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.